I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel, here today with Ron Pepperocki. See, we're going to talk about chocolate in a second. We're going to talk about pastry desserts, maybe even some baumkuchen. But first, we're going to talk about landscape design. And you're going to figure it all out in a second. But Rochester, New York, does it have food? Because it seems like this place between, what, Beef on Weck in Buffalo, maybe some Anchor Bar wings, and then the rest of New York. I mean, what is culinary life like there?
Well, we have Nick Tahoe's, which is famous for their garbage plate.
Tell me more about this garbage plate.
Nick Tahoe's is, first off, a place where you would go around 4 a.m. in the morning when you were done with your bar crawl. And you would order either a garbage plate with hamburger or hot dog. And what that consists of is two pieces of that meat served with a side of macaroni salad, hash browns, and this really dark, hot meat sauce kind of poured all over. And that's, I would say, is very iconic Rochester.
It's amazing to now describe something as a dark, hot meat sauce. I mean, being the pastry chef at Gotham Bar and Grill, how often would you get away with that little description?
not too often.
Yeah. So, I mean, you warded off food and you worked in landscape design.
Correct.
I mean, this was a decade of your life before you even ventured into pastry arts.
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, you know, growing up in Rochester, there's certainly, you're certainly limited to either the outdoors or staying inside. And my parents actually had 5 acres of land, and half of which was woods and half of it was what we cultivated. And so at an early age, I have no idea why, my father got me into plant identification. So we would walk through the woods and pick up a leaf or show me a branch if it was in the winter and say, what is this? And I don't know, it's a stick. I don't know, it's a leaf. It's a brown leaf. Definitely persistent and went deeper into that until I was able to identify plant material pretty good. And I got to liking it. And certainly that took off into, well, I'd like to get a job. and that's kind of where I started into the foray of landscaping.
Yeah, we all try to parlay those lessons into some kind of commerce. But, I mean, landscaping, you did enjoy. I mean, the methodology behind having this, you know, vacant piece of land and then creating this scene, it's very similar, I think, to the methodology of, you know, plating a dessert.
Exactly. You know, when I was into residential landscape design in Rochester, as we discussed earlier, where I would meet with a potential client and, discuss their landscaping needs or wants or what they like or dislike, and find a solution to their landscape problem, and would create a very nice, almost holistic sense to kind of complete and soften their home and their yard.
Yeah. Did you have signatures? Did you have certain things that you would always
there,
put in the log?
There were certain plant materials that were in my playbook that that would tend to reappear.
Yeah. You weren't like a African sorghum grass guy or fescue because it grows so quickly.
No, no, no. I think at the time, Blue Star Juniper was a big fan. Kwanzaa cherry, you know, it's an ornamental cherry tree that had a very nice double pink flower in the springtime. You know, certainly Japanese red leaf maple. I think those were a few of the hits that seemed to kind of touch or evoke everyone's senses in there. In their yard that yeah. I like to repeat.
So why did you vacate this profession and look towards pastry arts? I mean, you went to Germany.
Absolutely. You know, I had always loved baking, and that even started before, you know, I got into landscaping professionally. And I think it was around age 7, 8, and 9, you know, both my parents were working. I think it was about the time my mom went back to work from raising three children. I was one of the three. And so we would have the house to ourselves. And we would grab the Fanny Farmer cookbook, and we would start baking and making a big old mess. And, you know, one of the things is that we loved making just simple sugar cookies, oatmeal cookies, and it was just really the satisfaction of starting something almost from nothing, just from a handful of ingredients, and then creating it, that really excited me personally as a child.
Yeah, let's talk about how being a pastry chef in Germany works, because I think that's interesting too.
Yes.
Because you not only go to school, you have this apprenticeship, and within that apprenticeship, you only do so much.
Exactly. So I was lucky enough to do a full-on apprenticeship program in Germany. In German, it was called an Ausbildung. So I did an Ausbildung als Konditor. And a konditor is a pastry cook or pastry chef. And so first you would have to find a cafe or a konditorei that would sponsor you to go to school. And once you would do that, they would provide 5 days of employment for you. And also you would have to work, or I'm sorry, you would also go to school twice a week. And so it was a combination of practical knowledge as well as, you know, school knowledge.
Yeah, well, I mean, theory. I'm going to tell you all the German desserts or pastry desserts that I know.
Sure.
I mean, there's Berliner, which yes. is that whole JFK misunderstanding.
Exactly, but I am Berliner.
Baumkuchen, because my wife's last name is Kriegbaum,
yep.
and people refer to her as Baumkuchen.
Yeah.
How do you say Schwarzwalder?
It's Schwarzwalder Kirschtorte.
Yeah, it's
a Black Forest
Black
cake.
Black Forest cake. My favorite cake that I've ever converted into a cookie. Lebkuchen.
Lebkuchen.
Pfeffernuss.
Pfeffernuss.
And Stollen.
And Stollen.
And that is my German food lexicon
sure.
right there.
Well, those are all the hits.
Yeah. The greatest hits album.
Yeah.
Were those things that you learned in your apprentice, or are they things that you have to kind of research outside of that?
Well, you know, first starting with the Schwarzwalder Kirschtorte, believe it or not, it was a specialty pretty much wherever I ventured in Germany. Whether you're in one konditorei or bake shop or another, you'll always see that in some variation. And that was one cake that I learned at my place of employment that was very classic but very delicious. And there's certainly a lot of other variations of that. And I've seen in Bavaria in my travels where some konditoreis would put desiccated coconut in there as well, which I thought was always a little strange. But I'm more of a classic person that likes things that are very traditional way. But Stollen, Chris Stollen, for example, never knew the recipe from where I worked. The owner would have all the ingredients. You know, when we came into the Backstube, into the bakery kitchen in the morning at 4 a.m., he would unlock the door, and all the ingredients would be set out on the table, and then we would just have to combine them all. So that was a very secret recipe, and I eventually figured some of it out, but not all of it.
I mean, moving back to New York, you obviously, there's not the biggest German enclave here in fine dining, though there are some outlets.
Right.
what of that education did you take to New York and implore in places like Gordon Ramsay, which you worked, and then eventually at Gotham?
Yeah, well, the first job I held was back in 2004 at Financier Patisserie. And there I was brought on to bake a lot of the breakfast pastries. And in Germany, we would say the Dauerbackwaren, which just means non-refrigerated bakery items, pastry items. And so from there, I introduced the Mandelhornchen, which is an almond horn cookie. Basically, it's a one-to-one ratio of, we have marzipan, honey, and sugar. Yeah, mixed with some egg white to combine it, and you roll it into some blanched sliced almonds, and then bake them, and then you put a apricot glaze on after they're baked, and then dip a third of it into tempered chocolate. And it was very popular. I introduced that to Financier and a couple other things as well in that Dauerbackwaren line.
Yeah, I mean, were you happy to eventually get off that AM line and start working in more fine dining?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, and really, I started off in pastry in a bakery, if you will, in a confiserie, and then I came to New York doing essentially the same thing, but under a French trained chef. And you know, I was always looking to see what was beyond that into the restaurant field.
I mean, what was beyond the patisserie? What were you missing out on not being in fine dining?
And I would say energy. You know, really that rush of service, and that was definitely something that's lacking, in my opinion. In the bake shop. You know, certainly around the holidays, especially if you're making pies for Thanksgiving, I think you can obtain a similar rush doing that. But every night, every day, you know, in a restaurant, it's certainly a different environment.
And I also feel like when you work with something as classic as a patisserie, sometimes you lose out on seasonality. And, you know, the wonderful thing about Gotham Bar and Grill is that you're within striking distance of Union Square Green Market.
Yes, that's correct. You know, certainly in a pastry shop, you have your base items, and that brings people back. You know, they know that, oh, okay, I can get a pistachio torte, and it'll always be there. And then that's their repertoire. Certainly at a restaurant, being so close to Union Square, now you're working off the seasonality of the ingredients, of all the fruits that are there, also the herbs. And, it definitely could be a little more challenging doing that, but especially in the spring, in the early parts after a long winter. But it's certainly fun to do.
Yeah, I mean, you have a classic at Gotham that can never leave the menu, you know, the chocolate cake.
Yes.
But I mean, how do you put your touches? You're dealing with what? A number one Zagat rated, three-time, three-star New York Times. There's such ingrained legacy in a restaurant. How do you come into a place like that and, you know, make it Ron's?
Very, very carefully. You know, the one thing that I was told in the onset of starting at Gotham was, make the menu yours. Do not touch the Gotham cake. And so I did that. And really, it's just fine-tuning something that's already great. And from that point, I really took the chocolate to a new level and made that finer.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about, what is it, 28 square feet of your chocolate room at Gotham Bar and Grill.
Yes.
Putting out some of the most fantastic chocolate bars in New York City and beyond. You've been listening to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here again with Ron Paparaki of Gotham Bar and Grill, and now Gotham Chocolates. What you just gave me, I couldn't be more elated with. Six chocolate bars, you know, and, well, I'm not, I shouldn't say that I've two packs of six because I was going to hide one, but I can never get away with a lie. But these chocolate bars, aside from having the most beautiful packaging, and we'll get to that in a second, you know, this was a passion of yours and Brett's, the, what is it, general manager of Gotham Bar and Grill,
yes.
Trying to up the chocolate game.
Exactly.
I mean, why was chocolate such a fascination of yours, and why did you think there was a market to make better chocolate in New York?
Well, pastry chef, love to work with chocolate and always wanted to try to find a way to continue to work with it more and more. One thing that was a bit of a challenge at Gotham in the pastry kitchen was the heat. And certainly any temperature over 80 degrees is certainly going to diminish the quality of chocolate. And it was always a challenge to try and do that at Gotham. And about a year ago, it was a very cold. I think, it was last winter, not this past winter, but the winter prior, where it was the coldest February on record. Our kitchen was super cold, and we had people wearing turtlenecks in the kitchen, and that's when I said, okay, let's start working with chocolate. And I always wanted to make bonbons. I made them at Gordon Ramsay in the fine dining area on the bonbon trolley, and I started making them again.
Can you just say bonbon trolley one more time for me?
The bonbon trolley.
That is something I hope to aspire to, you know, just have a personal bonbon trolley. But yes, continue on.
Yes. So that gave me my first opportunity to start working with it. I always wanted to work with, you know, continue to work with chocolate, and I knew that I would be able to at some point at Gotham. And so once we started working with that, we started selling them for that Valentine's Day, and we were very successful. We figured if we sold 40 boxes, it'd be worthwhile to do it again. We ended up selling over 300 boxes. It overwhelmed us, but in a positive way, mm-hmm. not a negative way. And then we just started sparking ideas, and which kind of led to the winter thaw. And then it started to get warm in the kitchen. We started to look, where can I continue working? And we looked at some, you know, down the hallway where I used to have my dry storage. We looked at this area as being the best place to work with the chocolate. So we cleared all that out and put in an air conditioning unit, put in some refrigeration curtains, put in a sink nearby to make the health department happy.
Don't worry, the health department, well, they may be listening, so that's good that you mentioned that.
But we're legit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been making chocolate ever since, you know, that February of 15.
So you took this trip to Switzerland to,
yes.
How do you say, Fechlin?
To Fechlin.
Fechlin.
Yes.
Talk to me about that style of cocoa bean and what makes their chocolate so special.
Well, you know, their chocolate, you know, they really, you know, very, very simply put, they conch a lot of the chocolate that we're using on traditional conch machines. And it's a longitudinal conching machine, just like the old-fashioned Lindt commercial that you may see. You know, the quality of the beans that they're starting with is very high as well. And so the combination of a few factors of high quality and also very traditional methods really lend to a really superior product.
Yeah, we were joking before. Is there a DRC cocoa bean? And you mentioned one. I forget the name.
There's the Porcelana.
Yeah. Then a white bean?
There's a white, Yes. And, you know, there's a lot of other beans that fall on that high spectrum as well. This red bar, for instance, we're calling it the wild bar. That's sourced with 100% Bolivian beans that are foraged out in the wild, if you will, by the locals. And it's not a plantation product. It's just foraged. And the beans are very small. They don't offer a high yield. So it takes almost twice as much of the collection to make a normal amount of chocolate.
See, you know, I always read these notes on chocolate bars where it's like, you know, pure, powerful chocolate with light citrus notes. At what point of the process do you start getting those flavor profiles?
Well, really, the immediate, aside from what the plant's doing in terms of the terroir, if you will, where it's grown, in the fermentation stage is really the initial aspect from where the chocolate starts to take on its identity and flavor.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a pastry chef, especially one that has been using acidity for so long, how do you get that acidity, or how do you get such harmonious balance within a chocolate bar so it's not so one note?
Well, it's really through the fermentation as well as roasting.
Yeah.
And not overpowering it with an abundance of sugar or masking it with vanilla aroma.
So I'm looking at the packaging as well. And again, we were talking before about how beautiful these things are. And at first they kind of look between a tanagram and that children's book with the little mouse, Eric Weil, I forget, or the Hungry Hungry Caterpillar. They're very graphic. But yes. To you, they're very New York.
Absolutely. You know, we work with our designer and gave her definitely a lead into what direction we want to go. And we mentioned Frank Stella as well as Ellsworth Kelly into that New York, expressionism of art. And, you know, she came back with some of these ideas, and we morphed on that. And, one thing, if you lay out the six bars, you'll see that each one is some representation of a G, you know, for Gotham. At first sight, I don't think many people capture that, but they're capital or lowercase G symbols.
That's amazing. No, I mean, I'm going to say, yeah, I knew. Absolutely knew when I first saw them. But, I mean, putting them together, it creates this collection that you know, it's based off of very elemental, simple things, color, form, flavor.
Yes.
But what you can do out of that, you know, after you have foundation, you have creativity. How important is it to understand that as a pastry chef?
It's very important. And you really need to be forward thinking, and you need to be creative.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do right now, aside from the chocolate, that you think is the most creative thing in your pastry kitchen?
Well, I think the menu is a balanced menu, and we definitely have a lot of very classic desserts on the menu, as well as a couple forward thinking, if you will. And one of the desserts I really enjoy on my menu right now is the Black Forest dessert, because
I've heard that before. Black
yeah,
Forest.
Right.
Yeah.
Schwarzwälder Kirsch. It has all the flavors of the Black Forest cake. However, it's not what you would expect it to be.
Yeah.
And something like that, where there is that element of surprise in a positive way, not in a negative way. Certainly if it's in a negative way, you didn't do your job correctly. But that is a way that I keep, you know, in a sense, thinking forward by just always having a little twist on the menu, but certainly wanting to appease the masses in the process.
Yeah, and, you know, as a pastry chef, too, are you more towards old-school methodology? Are you using marble to temper your chocolate, or are you looking towards, you know, future technology and mechanics that make desserts or chocolate making better?
Yeah, you know, I think when there's definitely an approach that I have where I think it was back in 2009 or so when we had a lot of this Elber Adria, when his Natura book came out, and everyone, was kind of the masses of, there's still a lot of pastry chefs that knew about microwave cake, but it wasn't out into the masses. And so when a lot of this knowledge in the use of technology that you wouldn't normally see in a pastry kitchen, even just something as simple as a microwave and an ISI, canister to bake a cake and to really come up with something amazing, things like that were definitely very interesting to me at the time. But now, as I mature in my profession, I think that some of the more classic desserts definitely have a place in today's menu.
Yeah, I mean, which ones? Which desserts and techniques within those desserts?
Well, I mean, souffle.
Yeah.
Straight up souffle. I think souffle is making a big comeback. And the way we do it at Gotham is the same way I did it at Gordon Ramsay, and it was a la minute. And, there's ways where people would pre-make them and set them in the fridge, and when they're ready, you take them out of the fridge and you put them in the oven. And when we have a order come in, we immediately start whipping our egg whites with the sugar to make a French meringue. We're taking our pastry base and we're warming it over a double boiler at our station. And we fold the two together. And then we line the ramekin, butter, sugar, and fill it and bake it. And we say, please allow up to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And, sometimes we'll make two, because if one fails, we don't want the guest to wait 40 minutes. So something like that is definitely challenging at times, because considering the environment of the kitchen where it could be very humid and warm. But, it's a very simple recipe, and it's almost naked, if you will. There's not a lot of smoke in mirrors. It's the real deal, and that's that I enjoy.
Yeah. So you're saying you'll never open up a souffle truck?
No. Yes, I am saying that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But I love what you said, that it is very naked. It is very pure in that sense. And even making a crepe for the first time, or making any of those base things and getting it so well, that's why we go back to these classics. That's why a place like Gotham Barn Grill exists. You stick to these foundations, you stick to these legacies, but, it's those little tweaks and updates, and that's where old world meets new York.
Yes, I agree 100%.
Excellent. Well, then that's it. Unless there's anything else you want to say.
No, I think we're good.
Yeah. Well, again, check out Gotham Chocolates, one of the most beautiful packages, and stop by and order that 20-minute souffle at Gotham Barn Grill. I apologize for saying that, because whenever I see a menu and I see something that says, we'll take 20 minutes, we'll take 40 minutes, I usually am, I don't know whether or not to call myself an ass or, someone that the kitchen likes. I always order those things instantly.
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah, yeah.
We think it's great when people order that. So
yeah, that was the most litigious way of saying, you're a little bit of an ass, but I still like making souffles.
Well, the secret is that it really only takes 10 minutes. But
should have never said that on air. You're going to have to change your menu now. But stop by and see Ron's fantastic desserts at Gotham Barn Grill. Thank you again.
All right, thank you. My pleasure.
A big thank you to Corin for sponsoring, music by Cookies as always, and David for engineering. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.